Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger. In the heartland, in the bunker. Right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world and all the ships at sea. And all the satellites up in the sky, baby. Yeah, we got the wolf calls going. Have you heard the wolf call in your community? If you have a CB radio, we'll put the wolf call on. Let's get them howling everywhere around the country on Channel 5. Yeah, right. Yeah. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And address your mail to occupant, box holder, Tom Metzger, insurgent, or whatever yanks your crank, baby. Yeah.
Well, good morning, and today it is May the 13th, 2014. Doors, no, wait a minute, this is Tuesday. Boy, I tell you, I lose all track of time sometimes, yeah. Beautiful day out today. Oh, it's just gorgeous, nice and warm, and sun's shining, and birds are chirping. Yeah. Yeah, I've been out there doing a little manual labor. You know that Mexican manual? Trying to make my birds happy. Move my bird bath. Well, that's a heavy thing. It's about 75 pounds. I had to move it about half a block. That wore me out, babe. Did some weed eating, too. Did a whole lot of stuff around here this morning. But now I'm going to concentrate on you. I've decided, since I have quite a long list of a few hundred emails, of course some of them are probably no good anymore, that I need to send out a daily on various news updates, things that are going on, and my little comments. So if you happen to be on that list and you get something from me over there too, well, just disregard that. But I think what I'll do is send them out that way, and maybe I'll have to transfer some of your emails over on that list, but it'll still all be BCC. And also, merchandiseresist@yahoo.com, the webmaster told me she's got some new stuff up there on our little secret archive there that you donate $5 extra a month and you get another password and you can get into that. It's supposed to be a pretty hot interview I did quite a long time ago, I believe, with the blacks, some black group. Anyhow, she told me to pass that on to you. Well, let's get going here and let's see if we can find some more crap around the internet. And just remember, we're not right wing. We're not really left wing either. We're white racist. Yeah. We're not even necessarily white nationalists. Because I don't know whether I like this nation or not. There's a lot of things about the U.S. I don't like. So I'm going to call myself a world citizen of the Aryan type. Sort of like, white man's Bible and stuff like that. That's what we need to get people reading. I think you can go up on the internet and download it in PDF, I believe. Or you can order it from, I don't have that address on me, but someplace out west there. Rudy Stanko, yeah, he's got them. Well, let's see what those damn corporations are up to this morning. In an era in which corporations have been trying every possible stratagem to cut employee benefits, a new threat to retirement benefits has just arisen. The source of the threat is the Supreme Court. Oh, surprise, surprise. Which earlier this month agreed to rule on when or whether employees can unilaterally end retiree health care benefits, even when they're negotiated as part of a union contract. As Nichols Bagley of the University of Michigan Law School observes, federal law prohibits the unilateral reduction of retirement benefits retroactively. The law doesn't cover health benefits, however, as the Labor Department warns when employers do offer retiree health benefits, nothing in federal law prevents them from cutting or eliminating those benefits, unless they have made a specific promise to maintain the benefits. Well, I'll tell you, you always have to read the fine print, boys. You got to know a little bit about the law to protect yourself. The question raised in M&G Polymers versus Tackett is how specific that promise must be. M&G, a West Virginia chemical company, boy, they like to screw them down there in West Virginia, I know that, started demanding a contribution towards a health plan premium from all its retirees in 2007. A group of retirees led by one Hobart Freel Tackett sued, pointing out that the union contracts signed by the plant's predecessor owners, Goodyear and Shell, long before M&G took over in 2000, guaranteed a full company contribution for health care for its pensioners. A contract signed by the United Steelworkers in 2005 allowed for shared premiums, contributions for future retirees, but the company tried to impose them even on the already retired. As the company states, federal appellate courts are all over the lot in ruling on this issue. The Supreme Court has now accepted the chore of crafting a single rule, and I'll bet you it doesn't come down on the side of the workers. It's proper to observe that by accepting the case, the court already has dealt the workers a major setback. Their position was that this wasn't a legal dispute, but a factual one. And the lower courts had ruled that the company's witnesses had lied to the judges about what presumptions had governed the union negotiations before 2005. Judges in the Federal District Court and Appellate Court had consistently ruled in the workers' favor. Quote, "If I had to guess, this case won't go well for retirees," Begley writes. Quote, "Lots of companies would like to cut back on their retiree obligations." Of course they would, especially in the Rust Belt. Who caused the Rust Belt? You moved all the plants overseas to China and all over the place, Philippines, Mexico. You created the Rust Belt, bastards. The Sixth Circuit has held the line, but it's in the minority among the appeals courts that have ruled on this matter. If the Supreme Court casts its lot with other circuits, quote, "that could create financial hardship for thousands of retirees and give heartburn to their former unions," unquote. Oral arguments will take place this year. Watch out for this one. It could be another blow for the average working stiff. There you go. They're always out there trying to give you the old shaft, those big corporations, those capitalist pedophiles. Well, I see the Speaker of the House, Mr. Boehner, insists he is moving ahead, saying Monday that a Democratic boycott, quote, "will not impede the investigation." His office, though, would not say if Friday's proposal on the committee's rules was their final offer, or if talks with Democrats on investigations rules will continue. Oh, these guys are so slick. This is all false flag and flowers, man. Benghazi. Let's talk about how you assassinated or caused to assassinate or paid people to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi, the leader of his country. Now, how would you feel if that happened in this country? Oh, well, it couldn't happen here. Well, it's happened many times here, you stupid idiot. So you're going to get together and wave your arms and stomp your feet and cry like little baby. You guys didn't play for me. Oh, do you really care that four people died over there? Bullshit. No. You don't care. You're just interested in keeping the attention off more important things until the time for the election comes around. Yeah, I know how you guys operate. Same old stuff, new day. Well, the best way if you want to live as an American citizen, don't work for the government. Or don't work for the government overseas, that's for damn sure. Because if you get your ass blown away, whether you're military or not, if it's them or you, they're going to sweep it under the rug. Don't you know that? Well, let's see what Mr. Jew Sterling had to say on his interview yesterday with Anderson Cooper. In case you missed it.
You're racist.
I'm not a racist. I made a terrible, terrible mistake. And I'm here with you today to apologize and to ask for forgiveness for all the people that I've hurt. And I've hurt so many people, so many innocent people. And I've hurt myself. You know, I spoke to a girl that I was fond of. And I don't know why I can never, when I listen to that tape, I don't even know how I could say words like that. I'm not a racist. I love people. I always have. But those words came out of my mouth, I guess. And I'm so sorry. I'm so apologetic.
What are you sorry about?
Well, I'm sorry that so many people are hurt. My little grandchild goes to a Catholic nursery, and they were passing around candy to everybody when they got to her. They said, "We don't give candy to racists, 7 and 9. So it hurts me. I hurt my ex-wife. She is a beautiful person. She goes to the hospital and she's a volunteer at Cedars-Sinai. When I went to law school, she worked at the Children's Hospital. She's a giver. She works at this stage in her life. She still works. She didn't need this. Her whole life blew up.
Are you talking about Shelley?
Shelley, yes. I never dreamt that this could happen. It's a terrible, terrible nightmare.
Let me ask you, let's start by talking about the tape. Did you know you were being recorded?
No, of course not. Of course not. No.
Do you know when it was recorded? Were you together in a room with Vista Viana?
Yes. Well, I remember some of the dialogue in a living room.
So it was just you and her in the room?
And just the two of us, yes.
So you didn't know she was recording or there was a recording device?
No, I didn't know she was recording. And she was talking so strange all of a sudden about politics. But I want to explain a couple things that I said. One of the things that I said was, don't bring blacks to my game. Well, there's 25% of my whole game are black people. And I love them. She would always use the word black. That's a black girl. That's a black guy. This is black. That's black. So when she said to me, I'm going to bring 4 gorgeous black guys to the game, players she was referring to, either football or basketball, I was a little jealous maybe.
When did she say that?
Just before. And I said to her, don't bring them to the game. Because of my jealousy, I mean, in any event, she never brought anybody to the game. It was like she was baiting me just to say things.
So you're saying she, before the recording that we heard, she had said she was going to bring 4 black players, and she specifically said black players.
Yes.
And you're saying that's what this conversation stemmed from?
Yes. And so I used her words. I mean, I really have to apologize to all the people that have been hurt. For them to hear that I'm a possible racist is so painful to me because I'm not a racist and I've never been a racist.
When you saw them take off their warm up jerseys reverse and the name Clippers wasn't on in that first game, What did you think?
I really didn't pay attention to that. They are Clippers, and they're mine, and I'm theirs. That's how I feel. I would do anything for them. I made a mistake. I hope it's in their heart to forgive me for that mistake.
When you say
I
that
didn't
they're
mean
mine.
It, I said a few words. I don't know why the girl had me say those things.
You're saying you were set up.
Well, yes, I was baited. I mean, it's not the way I talk. I don't talk about people, for one thing, ever. Well, I talk about ideas and other things, but I don't talk about people.
Do you know how the tape got released?
No.
Do you think she did it?
I don't know. I mean, an 80-year-old man is kind of foolish, and I'm kind of foolish. I thought she liked me and really cared for me. I guess being 51 years older than her, I was deluding myself.
Were you in a relationship with her? An intimate relationship?
Well, I don't know what you mean by intimate. I think
she says you weren't. She told Barbara Walters that you weren't.
Well,
that she's your protector, she's your right hand.
I don't think a gentleman should discuss his, you know, any of the personal items that go on with a woman. And I
don't
want to answer
her?
That particular question.
Do you trust her now?
No, I don't trust her. And I just wish I could ask her why. And if she was just setting me up, I think that people say she was taping me for 2 years. So maybe I was just fooling myself, thinking for 2 years that she cared for me. She certainly acted like it.
Her lawyer had made a statement that she was your archivist.
What does that mean?
That
I mean, too young for archives.
You don't want to have your story written just yet?
No.
So you didn't know the tape was being made. When you first heard that the tape was released, did you automatically remember making those statements?
No.
A lawyer of hers claims that she gave some of the recordings to a friend and that one of the friends sold it to TMZ. Do you believe that?
I really don't know. I don't really want to talk about her. I want to talk about me and the mistakes that I made, and I want to correct them.
Okay, well, let's talk about you then. Let's talk about the tape itself. Let's talk about the actual statement.
I'm responsible. I wanted to apologize also to my partners. I have 29 partners in a league that's a wonderful league. I respect them, and I love every owner. Every owner knows me. I love the commissioner. I'm sure that it's terribly difficult for him to impose severe punishment because he knows me so well. But here he is trying his best. The league actually believes in doing everything in their power to eliminate it, you know, racism. And here he's sitting there behind his desk, I guess, and this explosion comes on his desk, and I feel bad that I caused it.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about the league. We're back with my exclusive interview with Donald Sterling, the first time he's talked since he was banned for life from the NBA for making racist comments. Now, so far you've heard him say repeatedly that he is sorry. You've also heard him say he was baited to make those comments. He told me, quote, "I don't know why the girl had me say those things," as if he had no control over his own words. We'll let you decide what to make of all of that. Just after the story broke last month, Magic Johnson tweeted that he and his wife Cookie, quote, "will never go to a Clippers game again as long as Donald Sterling is the owner." As you know, in the recordings of Sterling's rant, he berated DiStefano for being seen with the L.A. Lakers legend. In our interview, Sterling bashed Magic Johnson again, and I'm sure that what he said will be deeply offensive to many people. Magic Johnson, you know, has made a public comment. What do you have something to say to him?
What could I say to him? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm hurt, but it doesn't matter.
You're hurt that he said that he spoke out publicly.
I'm hurt that he called me up and he said, "Don't do anything. Wait until you hear from me." Then somebody called me later and said he doesn't want to be involved. And then he released the tape that I said to him, that I talked to him in confidence. I didn't give any interviews. You are my interview. I'm deciding if I like you. No, but I mean, here is a man who's, I don't know if I say this. He acts so holy. I mean, he made love to every girl in every city in America, and he had AIDS. And when he had those AIDS, I went to my synagogue and I prayed for him. I hoped he could live and be well. I didn't criticize him. I could have. Is he an example for children? You know, because he has money, he's able to treat himself. But Magic Johnson is irrelevant in this thing. He didn't do anything harmful to anybody, and I respect him, and I admire everything that he does. You know, I'd like to help even more if he would offer me an opportunity to help. I like to help minorities.
Magic Johnson had said that, you know, he would never attend a game while you were owner. Apparently, he showed up to a game today.
He would never what?
Attend a Clippers game as long as you were owner. And he came today to see the game.
He's there at the game.
Yeah.
I don't think it's worthy of even discussing such a stupid remark. But he lulled me into waiting a week. Do you know what I mean? He said, don't do anything.
He told you, you're saying he told you not to say anything?
Yeah, don't do anything. I know the girl. Don't do anything. I'll help you. I'm waiting and I'm waiting and I'm waiting.
What you're saying is Magic Johnson called you up or you called him up?
I don't know his phone number.
He called you up when the tape broke.
I don't call anybody.
He called
you
up.
I'm loyal to you.
He called you up when the tape came out and he told you not to say anything?
Yeah.
Why did he say don't say anything?
He just said, wait, be patient, I'll help you, we'll work it out.
Why do you think he said that?
I think he wanted me to just do nothing so he could buy the team. He thought maybe the whole thing would be resolved in 2 weeks. Well, what has he done? Can you tell me? Big Magic Johnson, what has he done?
Well, yes, he's a business person.
He's got AIDS. Did he do any business? I'd like... Did he help anybody in South L.A.?
Well, I think he has HIV. He doesn't actually have full-blown AIDS. But
well, what kind of a guy goes to every city, has sex with every girl, then he catches HIV? And is that someone we want to respect and tell our kids about? I think he should be ashamed of himself. I think he should go into the background. But what does he do for the black people? Doesn't do anything. You call up and say... Well, you know,
he's opened a lot of businesses in
people,
inner city neighborhoods.
The Jewish people have a company, and it's for people who want to borrow money and no interest. They want to give them a fishing pole. We want to help people. If they don't have the money, we'll loan it to you. You don't have interest, one day you'll pay us back.
Sir,
I'm just telling you, he does nothing. It's
sir,
all talk.
So you're saying that African Americans don't contribute to African American communities as much as Jewish
There's
people.
There's no African American. Never mind. I'm sorry. They all want to play golf with me. Everybody wants to be with me.
By the way, Magic Johnson has a foundation that's been around for 20 years that has raised millions of dollars for HIV/AIDS awareness and other things we'll tell you about a little bit more about later on this hour. And as you just saw, Sterling stopped himself before he finished that thought about African Americans. Earlier in the interview, though, he made it clear what he thinks on the subject of charitable works, his own and those of African Americans. And like the part you just heard, it started when I asked him about his relationship with Magic Johnson. You have talked to him?
Twice. And then, he's...
Did you apologize?
He knew the girl, he said. He knew the girl well.
Did you apologize to him? Or?
Well, if I said anything wrong, I'm sorry. He's a good person, and he... What am I going to say? Has he done everything he can do to help minorities? I don't think so. But I'll say it, you know. He's great. But I just don't think he is a good example for the children of Los Angeles, that he would go and do what he did and then get AIDS. I mean, come on. Maybe he doesn't think I could be a good owner. I remember when he came from Detroit, he came to my house. You know, he was a great player. But what I'd like to know exactly what he's What does he do? He works with the Dodgers.
Oh, he's got
do you know what I do?
Movie theater.
I spend millions on giving away and helping minorities. Does he do that? That's one problem I have. Jews, when they get successful, they will help their people. And some of the African Americans, maybe I'll get in trouble again, they don't want to help anybody. What has Magic Johnson really done for Children's Hospital? Which kids are lying in the hallways. They're sick. They need a bed. What has he done for any hospital? What has he done for any group? I don't know. Maybe he's done a lot. I know he's successful in business, but I'm not interested in business anymore at all. I'm interested in helping people. That's
but you are interested in business. You're interested in maintaining ownership of the Clippers. That's business.
That's
you could take hundreds of millions of dollars from the sale of the team and help whoever you wanted with that money.
And maybe I'll do that.
Well, a lot more on the facts, actual facts about Magic Johnson's track record of giving back. Just for the record, his charity, the Magic Johnson Foundation, which he founded in 1991, gets high ratings from Charity Navigator. It currently has 4 stars, the best rating possible. Foundation provides funds HIV/AIDS awareness, testing and treatment, as well as scholarships and mentoring for minority students and others, support to ethnically diverse urban communities. It's spent many millions of dollars on these programs over the last 20 years. And as chairman and CEO of Magic Johnson Enterprises, I should point out, Johnson has also invested heavily in millions in underserved urban communities.
So there you go. There you go. The black fellows and the Jew fellows got a little problem there. It runs a lot deeper than people want to talk about, too. But Sterling's correct about Magic Johnson running around with HIV, screwing every white woman he can find. I'm pretty sure he had a white woman at that ball game on TV there. But that's not our fight. Other than we should encourage it. If we can pour gasoline on that fire some way, do it. Well, I got so excited about listening to the Negroes and the Jews have a little spat there. I thought I heard some noise outside. I went upstairs and we had a typhoon, man. I'm very good shape down here in the bunker, but you can hardly hear anything. And I didn't have the intercom on, and we had a typhoon come through here. I'm telling you, that was something else. It's pretty much passed through now, but lots of water, man. I'll tell you. Got bad news for you New York Catholics, and maybe other Catholics too. Cardinal John O'Connor, the late Archbishop of New York City, was technically Jewish, according to new research. O'Connor's sister, Mary O'Connor Ward, recently discovered through genealogical research that her mother, Dorothy Gumpel O'Connor, was born Jewish but converted to Catholicism before she met and married O'Connor's father. Wow, man. Ward told a newspaper, Catholic New York, that she does not know whether or not the late cardinal, who died in 2000 at the age of 80, knew that his mother had been Jewish. Ward said her mother never spoke about her Jewish roots, but that when she was growing up, she surmised that her mother was a convert. Well, plenty of those popes were Jewish, no doubt about that. Of course, all the early formers of the Christian religion were basically Jews, too. Don't forget that. Did you know there was a lot of racism in Israeli Jew soccer? Uh-huh. Latest report out of Israel says they've got a lot of racism in Israeli soccer. Wait a minute. How could that possibly be? Well, the U.S. may have terrorist hands-off list. The Obama administration appears to have a terrorist hands-off list that permits individuals with extremist ties to enter the country, according to internal Department of Homeland Security DHS documents obtained by a United States senator. It's unimaginable that any government would do this. But it seems like the Obamsky administration is constantly breaking new ground. Oh, he wouldn't do that. Illegal aliens with serious criminal convictions. Besides implementing a flagrant amnesty plan that defies Congress and the rule of law, the Obamsky administration freed tens of thousands of illegal aliens convicted of violent and serious crimes last year, according to the government's own records. The crimes committed by illegal aliens released from federal custody include homicide, sexual assault, theft, kidnapping, and on it goes. I am shocked. Well, there's a new book out. Yeah, Matthew Cecil wrote it. Hoover's FBI and the Fourth Estate, the campaign to control the press and the Bureau's image. Matthew Cecil, a communications professor at Wichita State University, has resolved a conundrum that's bedeviled me since 1970 when I was a fledgling investigative reporter. I had just completed my first interaction with the Federal Bureau of Instigation, or is it the famous but incompetent, the supposedly crackerjack national law enforcement agencies. But the crackerjack part escaped me. My initial experience suggested an agency that produced inaccurate information inefficiently, failed to respect the constitutional liberties of U.S. citizens, and often resorted to intimidation and lies to get their way. Yet many of my journalistic betters told me I was misguided. Smart people who think that they are well informed about a subject say the Federal Bureau of Investigation's role as the nation's elite law enforcement agency usually know what they think, and they know based upon exposure to mass media, television, radio, newspapers, magazines, and books. But when mass media has been corrupted, the reliability of the knowledge becomes suspect. That's the case with the FBI. Well, that's the case of the Southern Poverty Law Center, how they gather all this information. They gather all this information from biased books and biased newspapers and biased radio shows and biased movies, of course. As Hoover's FBI and the Fourth Estate, the campaign to control the press and the Bureau's image, shows, the performance of supposedly first-rate FBI agents has been dismal time and again when the citizens of the United States needed them most, including perhaps the most notable run-up events to September 11, 2001. They really blew that. Really. Readers of Who, What, and Why will be familiar with our frequent reports of problems with FBI operations and may be asking themselves, why don't I see this in the media? The answer is in this book. What the FBI excelled at, especially under the longtime Chief J. Edgar, cross-dresser, and who knows what else, was a nonstop public relations campaign that portrayed the agency as a heroic band of G-men who skillfully tracked and felled dangerous criminals. Actually, J. Edgar was a homosexual, and I have that straight from another agency. Information. Tales of the FBI's infallible laboratory and army of honest and professional agents became part of popular culture. Remember all those Ephraim Zimbalist TV shows? The FBI was so clean and uncorrupted and dressed well, and all these nice looking Aryan type men. Thanks to mass media, the FBI was widely considered to be an indispensable government agency. In fact, in all too many cases, dangerous criminals were eluding capture, while the infallible forensic laboratory wrongly analyzed evidence again and again, leading to the pursuit and convictions of innocent individuals. The publicity juggernaut to gild the FBI's image began during the directorship of J. Edgar Hoover. He died in 1972 after 48 years at the helm. But the campaign he initiated was so pervasive and the propaganda he peddled so appealing that the image of incorruptible, invincible agent heroes lives on in perpetuity. In fact, the agency's full of alcoholics, drug addicts, liars, whoremongers, and so forth, and spies for other countries. Only gradually, since Hoover's death, has the true story of the FBI begun to emerge. As Cecil explains, the course of events and countless investigations have exposed a lawless and uncontrolled bureau that expended enormous amounts of time and resources policing political thought rather than investigating violations of federal law. Hoover had ultimately transformed the Bureau into an American secret police force, even as he convinced the public and many in the news media that he was a trustworthy defender of civil liberties. Cecil says he wanted his book to reveal how, in a nation so proud of its watchdog press, a high-profile federal agency managed to hide the reality of its activities for so long. The answer is as complex as the FBI's decades-long deception, but it surely includes failings entrenched in the ideology of journalism and in the readers' and viewers' often uncritical acceptance of news as truth. Well, it must be true. It's in the newspaper. I heard it on the television. The reference to the watchdog press is central here. Yes, starting in the first decade of the 20th century, what today we call investigative reporting began to take root in the U.S. media, but no more than a handful of media organizations ever practiced serious investigative journalism. The vast majority of journalists were too untrained or too lazy or gullible or corrupt to seek the truth behind the FBI's public relations facade. Unfortunately, as Cecil points out, many, probably most consumers of news cannot or will not distinguish the excellent journalists from the untrained, lazy, gullible, and corrupt ones, and therefore have no idea whom to believe about the FBI. Through wise choice of media outlets and via pure luck, some consumers of mass media inevitably learn the ugly truth about the famous but incompetent, while most never did. In the book's introduction, Cecil renders the abridged history of the FBI public relations campaign. After a few tentative steps into the realm of publicity during the late 1920s, the Bureau became a key element of FDR's New Deal war on crime in the mid-30s. Two journalists, independent author Courtney Riley Cooper and Neil Rex Collier, collaborated with Hoover and his top lieutenants to create a template for FBI news stories emphasizing responsibility and science and featuring Hoover as America's always careful and reliable top law enforcement officer. With the creation of the public relations-oriented crime records section in 1935, and the establishment of clear lines of public communication authority, Hoover had done a public relations message and a management team to amplify and enforce it, unquote. During the mid-30s, Collier, a Washington Star reporter, oversaw a comic strip called War on Crime that ran for 2 years in 80 newspapers across the United States. Cecil summarizes that the first 6 weeks of the strip, week one of War on Crime, focused on Hoover, who Collier wrote in the comic strip's text, had the vision of a man twice his age. Hoover had cleaned up the Bureau, and now he had men of unassailable integrity in the field, unquote. After touting the agent's grueling training regimen and the cutting-edge science of the FBI's crime-fighting laboratory, the strip focused on the agency's success in capturing criminals. quote, "In the morgue of the fingerprint division are the canceled records of criminals removed from circulation, such as Dillinger, Floyd, and Nelson." Cooper had worked as a publicist for a circus before turning to the newspaper feature writing. He met Hoover in 1933 while rewriting a profile of the FBI chief for American Magazine. After completing the rewrite, Cooper suggested a more permanent arrangement to Hoover. Soon articles ghostwritten by Cooper and the FBI about the FBI began to appear in magazines and newspapers under Hoover's byline. Other pieces appeared under Cooper's name after the FBI staff had carefully vetted them. Among the influential periodicals that published such public relations material as News were the respectable magazines of Cosmopolitan and the Saturday Evening Post. Cecil notes, quote, "At a time when Americans were desperate for government to do something right, the FBI's pursuit and elimination of John Dillinger and the other Robin Hood outlaws of the Midwest provided a compelling hook on which to hang the Bureau's reputation." Hoover built on that narrative, erecting an FBI built not only on real law enforcement innovation, but also on manufactured public relations foundation that hid mistakes and excesses from the public view for nearly 40 years, unquote. Accused bank robber Benny Dixon, for example, died on a St. Louis street during 1939 when he supposedly threatened to unload his weapon in the direction of four FBI agents. Cecil relying on a previously undisclosed FBI report shows that Dixon was actually trying to flee the scene when a trigger-happy agent shot him in the back. The evidence appears overwhelming that in the aftermath of Dixon's death, FBI agents coordinated their accounts, offered perjured testimony, and threatened a key witness into silence after she had told the truth. Cecil says that holes first began to appear in the FBI's holier-than-thou image around 1940. Media accounts of agents falsifying testimony, conducting illegal wiretaps, and raiding homes of Americans involved in the Spanish Civil War brought the agency unwanted attention. Hoover found ways to fight back. His staff maintained lists of hundreds of journalists and categorized each as a friend or foe. Foes were denied access to FBI information, while friends, like famed columnist Walter Winchell, got insider tips they could use, often unattributed to spin coverage of specific investigations and to burnish the FBI's overall reputation. Got a book, I've got some stuff in my library about Walter Winchell, what a rat he was, and Drew Pearson, I have a book about him, calling him the All-American Louse. Many of these top media people of the 30s, 40s, 50s were all bought and paid for by the Jews and others. While most major media outlets willingly joined the pro-FBI chorus, low-circulation intellectual magazines like The Nation and The New Republic probed a little deeper. Fred Cook's critical reporting about the FBI filled the entire 58 pages of The Nation magazine for October 18, 1958. Cook questioned the American public's worship of an agency that was part heroic fact, to be sure, but also part heroic myth. Cook would expand the magazine tour de force until and into 1964 book, quote, "The FBI Nobody Knows," another revelation. While trying without success to refute Cook's facts, Hoover and his supporters accused him and other critics of being un-American, a charge that bore considerable weight during the communist hunting hysteria of the 50s. I remember it well. Let's see here. But even Fred Cook's hard-hitting expose could not come close to neutralizing the bureau-friendly journalism of Don Whitehead. Whitehead had established his credentials as a newspaper reporter and war correspondent by the time he completed an authorized history of the FBI in 1956. The FBI story, A Report to the People, became a big seller. Whitehead had no qualms about FBI censors vetting his manuscript. In discussing the agency's propensity for tapping telephones and bugging private homes and offices, Whitehead compared these actions to a potential employer examining every possible source for information as to the honesty and reliability of a prospective employee. As Cecil sees it, Whitehead sold out his own journalistic credibility to the heroic history of the famous but incompetent. Hoover counted on the public's logical conclusion that a famed, objective journalist had reviewed the evidence and verified the Bureau's history as it had always been told. Yeah. In 1959, Whitehead's book became the basis of a popular motion picture, also titled The FBI Story, starring Jimmy Stewart. And when Hoover moved the FBI story into television in 1965, carefully selecting scriptwriters were provided copies of Whitehead's book. Under press liaison Louis B. Nichols, FBI staff edited and rewrote news, feature, and magazine stories produced by cooperative reporters, plus rewrote scripts for radio, television, and film. You see, boys and girls, most of what we have known has been a lie all along. Has been a lie from the beginning. Are you beginning to catch on to that? In 1965, the hour-long television drama, The FBI, started airing on ABC Network, a co-production of Warner Brothers and Quinn Martin. I used to watch that show. Oh, boy. I was no kid anymore, but I watched it once in a while. The dramatization of FBI cases reached millions of viewers each week, 241 episodes over a 9-year period, not including reruns and syndication showings. An FBI agent worked on the set. FBI employees reviewed and rewrote the scripts line by line. And the agency had the right to approve production crew members and performers and advertisers. Well, this goes on with the military, too. The military maintains offices right there in Hollywood to promote war-friendly movies. They've been there for decades and decades. And they're there promoting the military-industrial complex 365 days a year. That's why you get a lot of these wonderful war stories. Yeah. The FBI censors objected to scenes in which agents killed criminals because that seemed to indicate a lack of responsibility. In addition to limiting violence, FBI reviewers rejected scripts that showed agents drinking alcohol, using diet pills to make their weight requirements, exercising poor judgment, losing their composure, and demonstrating excessive compassion for criminals. The censors insisted any reference to wiretapping be omitted. I watched episodes of the television drama while in my final year of high school and during my freshman year of college, and swallowed whole the idealized image of the famous but incompetent. But in the years since 1970, when I began my career as a professional journalist, I have cast a skeptical eye on all kinds of institutional glorification. I now know that much of the FBI story I bought qualified as bullshit. Oh, I got a comrade in arms there. He likes that word, too. In this book, Cecil spells out how Americans were sold an image of an FBI beyond reproach. It's not only a solid, fascinating work of history, it's a cautionary tale against current and future attempts to mold public opinion about government actions in the face of inconvenient facts. Well, it's totally beyond the pale now. Everything is warped, corrupted, and changed. Nothing is straight anymore, boys and girls. This gives you a little bit idea of that, and that was the book Hoover's FBI and the Fourth Estate, : The Campaign to Control the Press and the Bureau's Image, by Matthew Cecil, C-E-C-I-L, University Press of Kansas. 355 pages, cost right now, brand new, $34.95. But wait around a while and you'll be able to get it a lot cheaper, possibly even in paperback. But I'd recommend that book be read. Most of you won't be surprised, but I think there's probably a lot more good stuff inside about the famous but incompetent. I can always still see that vision of my friend who was a contract FBI agent for a while. He called himself the old coon hunter. And I've told you this, they used to, J. Edgar Hoover and his girlfriend, I'm always forgetting his name, used to rent a bungalow down there at the country club. They're not only about half an hour drive from where I lived in Fallbrook, California, called La Costa Country Club. And in that bungalow, his girlfriend would go out, his male girlfriend, and he would buy grapes at the grocery store and bring them back to the bungalow, and he would tie them onto a small tree outside the window of the bungalow so that he and J. Edgar could lay in the bed, reach out the window, and pluck these grapes to eat. So get that image in your mind. A little short, fat fuck like J. Edgar Hoover and I forget his girlfriend's name, Toland or something like that. Anyhow, these guys entwined in each other's arms, eating grapes through the window, open window of a tree of a bungalow. and the guy swore that he knew that for an absolute fact. Okay. Well, you've heard about a lot of these guys that have been blowing a whistle and releasing a lot of information, you know, like Snowden and the boys. Well, there's another guy, his name is Barrett Brown. He just struck a deal with the feds. Hacktivist journalist Barrett Brown pled guilty to 3 charges on April the 29th after striking an agreement with the federal prosecutors that cut the possible prison time he faced from 105 years to 8.5 years. His sentencing is set for August the 18th. Take a look here for more details on the case, which had been under a gag order. Let's see what it's got to say. They released and unsealed quite a bit of his trial, or his, not trial, but the charges against him. Brown only pleaded to 3 counts, transmitting a threat in interstate commerce. That interstate commerce clause is one of the most anti-constitutional laws we got set up. Interstate commerce. That's an integral part of any dictatorship. Accessory after the fact to unauthorized access to protected computer and interfering with the execution of a search warrant. That could mean anything. Statutorily faces a maximum sentence of 102 months imprisonment, 8.5 years, but will likely serve considerably less. The order was eagerly anticipated, as for some time the prosecution has been abusing its power to request. Where did that come from? Abusing its power to request the sealing of documents simply in order to block media scrutiny. Ha! Media scrutiny! That's a laugh. While we welcome the sunshine, some aspects of this case, such as detention hearing, still remain sealed for no justifiable reason. Well, far as I'm concerned, it's another patriot being persecuted. Any of these guys that expose information that the public should know about, they should be pinning medals on them, not sending them to prison. You notice all these guys are white guys that are doing this too. Guys with the smarts. Keep it up, boys. I'm on your side. Release every piece of information you can on this rotten government. Now, shortly after this Benghazi situation, Susan Rice, then Obama's UN ambassador, claimed publicly that the uprising was spontaneous, a reaction to an anti-Islam YouTube video that had just aired. She and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and others soon came under severe attack for purposely, purportedly making a false claim to deflect attention from administration security failures, and the blogosphere has continued to resound with the issue ever since. The GOP, the Republicrats, along with their allies at Fox News and elsewhere, insistently drummed allegations that the Obama administration was responsible for the tragedy. The charges have ranged from failure to address al-Qaeda, purportedly their presence in Benghazi, to not properly controlling weaponry in the hand of local militias, of which they're all over the place. These critics also decry what they say is a long-running cover-up. According to one count, nearly 80% of the House Republicans now say they want a Watergate-style inquiry convened. Liberals have charged the Republicans with being reckless, partisan, and exhibiting lunacy. Recently, the controversy's simmer went back to boil when the New York Times published an investigative report on Benghazi. Some of its conclusions vindicated the Obama administration. It concluded that there was no al-Qaeda role, and that indeed the inflammatory video may have played some role. However, while finding that the crowd attack was partially spontaneous, the paper's reporter suggested that some intelligence lapses might have contributed. Specifically, he laid out superficial evidence that a local non-Al-Qaeda militia leader played some possible role as an inciter and sympathizer with the attack, and that the man should have already been drawing scrutiny from American spies and the CIA. In other words, a kind of draw with neither the GOP or the Obama administration fully vindicated. In other words, they didn't know what the fuck was going on. They got all these gangs of people like East L.A., you know, running around over there, setting fire, blowing things up. They act like this Al-Qaeda's uniform-wearing, heel-clicking, goose-stepping bunch. They're not. They're insurgents. When the Times piece came out, the GOP and its echo chamber, including Donald Trump, oh boy, race to accuse the paper of covering up the role of al-Qaeda in the attacks. By most accounts, though, the critique is dependent upon perpetuating a still popular, though overly simplified, notion of al-Qaeda as a unified, globe-girdling command, ignoring the local origins of so much Islamic activity. The perpetuation of al-Qaeda threat has worked well because it continues as an easy sell for those stocking the fear machine, and there you've got it. Now they're going to go in there and waste hour upon hour going over and over and over on this thing. What we have is unconventional warfare over there. Anybody could have done that. And this idea that the al-Qaeda is running around with a strict Nazi command type situation is stupid. It's stupid. And the main thing that's stupid is that we're over there at all. In other words, that it's okay for us to be over there getting the shit shot out of us, out of young men that go over there. That's okay. But then when something goes wrong like this, they could scream and fight and go on and on. But it's simply unconventional warfare, like sooner or later will be quite a bit of that in this country, but it's not time yet. Not time yet. Time will come. But you see, the United States military machine has always got to have an enemy that's a absolutely identifiable and so forth, like they did, not Saddam Hussein, but, you know, the other one we killed. Chase him all around. Like he controlled everything in the world, which was bullshit. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. And I hope you got something out of this show, because there was quite a bit of meat there. If you can digest it, 14-5, and shut up.
You know, there are some things you never see. A puppet with a heart on. A butterfly with a swastika design. The Latin word for douchebag. Someone defecating in a church. A junkie with leisure time. A serial killer with a light-up bow tie. A mom-and-pop steel mill. A shot glass full of carrot juice. A bum with matching luggage. Really interesting twins. Condoms with pictures of the saints. Two homosexuals who own a bait shop. A pimp with a low profit margin. Or a Rolls Royce that's more than 50% primer paint.